Welcome to Book Waves
on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Alan Hollinghurst, whose latest novel is The Stranger's Child. Earlier novels, The Line of Beauty, The Spell, The Folding Star, and The Swimming Pool Library. The Stranger's Child takes place over close to 100 years, a bit less, and involves the nature of memory and of memoir, along with it a history of class in England, as well as attitudes toward homosexuality. It's a far-ranging book. It's also, in its own way, a mystery, which I found fascinating because in an interview, you said that your goal was to write a historical novel that never read like a historical novel.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I'm quite wary of the historical novel, and certainly I think it would be beyond me to write the kind of historical novel which, you know, Tolstoy or someone might have done, which had battle scenes in it. I knew I wanted to write a book which was partly about the First World War, but I wasn't actually going to treat the First World War directly. In fact, it struck me that it would really be rather ridiculous and unnecessary for me to do so. I mean, it would be pure research, pure imitation of other writers who had written about it already. And I think what I always like to do is to write about the more intimate lives of my characters and hope that larger historical questions become apparent through those usually more domestic-scaled stories.
It consists of five different segments. The first segment is about 120 pages, takes place in 1913, and more or less covers a weekend. The second takes place 13 years later, 1926, and is pretty much just the story of one particular party, and that takes us past page 200. Did you know where you were going as you were writing those? In other words, was the second half of the book, which reflects back in many ways on the first half, was that always the intention?
Yes, very much so. When I started writing as opposed to starting planning, a lot of things were very uncertain in my mind when I started to plan the book. And in a book which, as you say, covers nearly a century in which almost everything is left out, the decisions about what was going to go in were quite tricky ones to make. But I wanted the first section to provide, as it were, a text over which the rest of the novel would keep on passing its gaze and seeing it in different lights and with different degrees of clarity. As you say, the first two sections are both a weekend party, in effect. So they're very concentrated in time. After that, the third and fourth sections are slightly more expansive. But really, I wanted, yes, to create sort of quintessential moments in the first part. The second part is one in which survivors from the first part are gathered ostensibly to discuss the subject of this dead poet's life. But it soon becomes clear that actually very little of the truth is going to be told. And so we have to wait until later installments of the book for people far more remote in time from the events to try and work out what had actually happened 50 or 60 years earlier.
As I was finishing the book, it occurred to me that what you could have done but didn't do was take that first section and move that to the end. Was that ever a consideration?
It wasn't, actually, no. I wanted very much to write a book which, in each section, the reader was plunged into the present day of the period with no knowledge of what was going to happen in the future. I wanted to create that, you know, the sense in which we all live in our ignorant present, which is why the book doesn't have a framing narrative. It's very much about looking back and trying to understand the past, but it doesn't use that device which I used in earlier books of someone being put in possession of documents, letters or diaries or something which enable them to enter the past. Each section is, I hope, told as if it were in the present day with no consciousness, as it were, of its own historicity. Again, it's a thing about trying to avoid the historical novel, I suppose.
In a sense, the mystery of what happens is solved at the beginning before we see people trying to puzzle out the mystery. So if you'd put it the other way, the reader would have solved the mystery in a way that no one else did. But in essence, by turning it on its head, you're doing something entirely different.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, quite what the mysteries are. I don't know how much we can say about this without giving things away. I know already it's a difficult book to talk about without giving things away. And the structure is one which I hope constantly surprises the reader. With each new section, the reader's plunged into a situation where it'll take them a page or two to get their bearings. And sometimes as much as 40 years has passed since the previous section. Characters have aged, they've perhaps got married, changed their names, they're not immediately recognisable as the same person. So there's sort of an element of mystery introduced structurally, I think, just by the uncertainty that the reader will have. The reader will share the uncertainty of the characters themselves as to what went on. The reader is privy to certain bits of knowledge, knows that a particular person kissed a particular person, but a great deal is concealed. But one reason I did that was because I wanted there to be a sort of, as you say, a mystery about the private lives of these characters. I wanted the reader to be in as much uncertainty about what had happened in the past between people as other people in the story itself are.
We don't know everything, which brings up the question, do you?
I don't think I do, probably, no. I had to give, I suppose, a sketchy account to myself of just what might have happened to the characters in these gaps between the sections. But I don't think I could really, you know, sit and examine on this.
There's something in a mystery where if you know you're going to pull out a gun, you have to put it in the handbag. Were there any cases where later on in the book you take out the metaphorical gun and then you had to go back and rewrite earlier on and put it in the handbag?
I think I pretty well avoided that by kind of planning it carefully enough. I didn't actually write it completely in a completely linear way. And perhaps occasionally, I've now, to be honest, slightly forgotten, but I felt I couldn't write this earlier scene until I saw what was going to depend on it in a later section of the book. I think there were a couple of instances of that.
Alan Hollinghurst, let's get back to the primary subject of the book and how you came to write it. And the subject is kind of a fictional version of Rupert Brooke, the English poet who died in World War I. Now, you have another person who is not in the book named Rupert Brooke, but it's pretty clear that Cecil Valence is Rupert Brooke. What made you point to that and point to World War I as being kind of a key to the entire book?
I don't think of Cecil as being Rupert Brooke. And as you say, I introduce various references to Rupert Brooke in the way that novelists do, I think, when they've got someone who shares a lot with a real person to indicate that it's not actually that person. He's a bit younger than Brooke. He's not so ridiculously beautiful. But I did take from Brooke various things about him, the unsatisfactory, abundant nature of his sort of amorous relations with other people, the element long concealed of Brooke's bisexuality. And the thing that interested me most, really, Brooke's reputation and its history after his early death. I mean, he didn't die in action, he died of a mosquito bite. But Winston Churchill wrote about him in the Times after he died as a sort of emblematic figure of the beautiful youth generation which was being eradicated by the war. There were people with a strong vested interest in maintaining this fictional icon, I think, particularly the very domineering mother that Brooke and Cecil in my book have, the person who controls the writing of the memoir about her son and makes sure that nothing untoward is said in it. And in Brooke's case, his letters were published in the late 1960s, but with huge omissions and censorings by his literary executor, Geoffrey Keynes, who'd obviously been in love with Brooke himself. And it really wasn't until the 90s, I think, that extraordinary letters of Brooke's talking about his sexual experiences with other men finally were made public. So I was interested in the forces trying to maintain this highly sanitized and idealized image of the dead poet and the long, slow process of the truth emerging.
If the truth is actually emerging, which is another question. 2 Acres, his famous poem, in an interview in Esquire, the author seems to think that that's based on a Rupert Brooke poem because there are certain lines that are similar. How much of 2 Acres did you write? Are we seeing the entire poem insofar as Alan Hollinghurst wrote it?
Again, it's rather like what I know about what happened in between the sections. Yes, the poem 2 Acres is clearly in some ways like Rupert Brooke's famous poem, The Old Vicarage, Grantchester. And they were both, they're in the same form. They were both written before the war, but after the war, again, came to seem like emblematic pictures of the England that had been fought for, I suppose, but also in a way an England that had been lost. And I was worried for a while that I was going to have to write this 159 poem. but then I realized that, rather as with Brooke's poem, that the point of it was going to be that it became very well known. It was something which people alluded to, perhaps knew a couplet from, knew a phrase from. So really all I had to do was sort of hint at its existence. So I think I only wrote about 12 or 15 lines of it in the end.
Well, it's kind of problematic because any time in a film or a book when you have a famous, you know, poem or song, and then we actually hear the poem or the song, we're going, that wouldn't have been famous.
Yes, I mean, it is obviously rather essential to me that Cecil was going to be a fairly second-rate poet. I think it's very difficult and problematic inventing first-rate writers because, A, you have to invent their first-rate works, and B, you then have to insinuate them into a literary history, which, if they were first-rate writers, they would have shaped and altered. So it's quite easy to smuggle in second-rate poets, I think.
Alan Hollinghurst, you have several characters in the book. In part one, most of the book takes place through the eyes of a character named Daphne, which means, is this the first time you've actually written from a female point of view?
I think it is, actually, yes. I had sort of quite central female characters in the line of beauty, but the whole of the book was seen from the point of view of one character, young Nick, its protagonist. She's one of the voices of the first two sections of the book. And when I started, I think I thought she was going to be more dominant, and I wondered if I, rather as with The Line of Beauty, I could write the whole of the first section seen from her viewpoint. But it was very problematic, because the point of this weekend is that all sorts of other things are going on that she doesn't know about, and which I really needed the reader to know about. So then I decided that her brother George would have some, and her brother Hubert has a couple of short chapters, and her mother has a couple of chapters. And actually, this was sort of what the book was about, because there wasn't going to be just the one account of this weekend, but there were going to be these conflicting and perhaps irresolvable different accounts of it.
The Stranger's Child comes from Tennyson. What made you determine that? Should we be looking at the character of Paul, who's a major character in the second half of the book, as the Stranger's Child?
I think of him as being that, really, yes. I mean, the phrase, as you say, comes from In Memoriam, and passage from it that Cecil reads to the other guests after dinner one evening during his visit to Two Acres in the first part of the book. And it's the section where Tennyson imagines the landscape where he's grown up after he and everyone he knows has left it. And he imagines the years turning and the stream running down until way in the future the landscape grows familiar to the stranger's child. That is to say, you know, not only to people we don't know, but to future generations of people we don't know. And I suppose Cecil's reputation or story is in the hands of this unknown person of a future generation, and all our reputations and stories will be, in effect. So he sort of is, I think, if anyone is, yes. I mean, I thought of it more as a sort of abstract idea, just for that kind of unknowable futurity that we all face. Yes, if anybody is the stranger's child, I think it's him.
Was there any particular character that you yourself identified with more than others, in particular either Paul or his friend Peter?
I think I've put bits of myself into both of them. These are two young men in the section of the book set in 1967 in a sleepy provincial market town. One is a bank clerk, the other's a school teacher. One is very innocent and inexperienced, and the other rather the opposite. The third section of the book is a sort of slow coming together of these two young men. I deliberately deprived Paul as a protagonist of things which I normally heap on my protagonist, which is all sorts of interests of my own, but you know, an interest in Wagner and things like that. So I deliberately made him a character who wasn't interested in music at all, and, you know, was tone deaf, whereas Peter is the one who plays the piano and so forth. I don't think of either of them as being a sort of self-portrait. I think I was probably doing what I always do, which is putting bits of myself into different characters, and it's like sort of having a conversation with yourself in a way.
The prep school you went to, was that the model for the prep school, Corley Court, in the book? And Dudley, one character, kind of changes Corley Court in the 20s, hiding what's behind it. Was that a deliberate metaphor for the entire book?
It has a certain metaphorical effect, yes. Corley Court is a high Victorian Gothic house of a kind thought very splendid by the new money people who built it in the 1880s, I suppose. The generation after the First World War, of course, had this tremendous sort of revulsion against all things Victorian. So Dudley, who inherits the house, is engaged in this process of boxing in all the extravagant Victorian decoration and putting these sort of clean, white, modern, again, rather sort of sanitized interiors into the house, which, of course, has the benign effect of protecting all this decoration, so that in the 60s, when Victorian building is sort of rediscovered and being championed again, these things could be rediscovered underneath. It's sort of historically accurate. I mean, I think I wanted the house to be a sort of gauge of changes in taste, but it also does obviously works as a sort of metaphorical thing for the whole book.
The book also serves as a kind of history of attitudes toward homosexuality, where they do not exist at the beginning, yet I think Paul or Peter says at one point doing the research, my God, were they all gay?
Yes, that's right. I mean, as you say at the beginning, this is a subject which sort of can't be mentioned at all. It's clearly simmering under the surface in the second part of the book in the 1920s when a sort of senior literary figure himself, clearly very smitten with Cecil when he met him before the war and during the war, is trying to compile this memoir of him. And he has a long scene in the chapel where Cecil is buried, obviously suspecting that George Saul, whom he's speaking to, had had an affair with Cecil, but neither of them actually being able to say what their feelings about him were. The key section in that respect, I suppose, is the middle one set in 1967, which is set on the eve of the passing of the Sexual Offences Act in Britain, which decriminalised homosexuality. And this is imminent event, as alluded to in one of the scenes. And, of course, this didn't change things overnight, but it ushered in a new period in which it became possible to say things about the private lives of figures in the past. I mean, the great book which came along very soon after that was Michael Holroyd's biography of Lytton Strachey, which was really the first book which wrote fully and unembarrassedly about the private life of a gay writer. You know, by the end of the book, young Paul, who then goes on to write a biography of Cecil Valance in the 80s, is perhaps over-exploiting these new freedoms that have been granted him. But yes, there's certainly a change from the beginning. The reader of a biography in 1913 wouldn't have expected to learn any intimate details about the subject's private life. The reader of a biography now would feel cheated if they weren't given every sort of intimate detail of the sex life of the subject.
Was the term womanizer used to denote heterosexuals, or was that Alan Hollinghurst kind of having little fun?
I picked that up actually reading Lytton Strachey's letters. I think it was a Cambridge joke, yes. Anybody who wasn't queer was called a womanizer.
How much research did you actually do for those early sections about a weekend at an upper-class home and later on the effects of World War I during the 1920s in England?
Not a lot, actually. I mean, most of it was of a fairly literary kind. As it happened, I'd immersed myself in Strachey because I'd reviewed his letters for the New York Review, so I read everything by Strachey, and I could see that this was going to be very germane to the novel I was planning at the time. I read other great memoirs of the First World War and books in which one also traced the aftermath of the war and the effects it had in the lives of the writers. I'm generally rather against doing too much research because I think it sort of has a way of showing itself as such in the finished product. I mean, you have to get details right. I think I would sort of check things more than researching them, probably.
If Rupert Brooke is/is not Cecil Valance, is Ralph Revel Cecil Beaton, or am I completely wrong?
He perhaps has something of him, yes. I was actually thinking more of the artist Rex Whistler, who was very much part of that Beaton world, and was a famous muralist. He did beautiful sort of fanciful sort of Rococo type murals and stage designs, but wasn't, I think, really gay like Revel is. He probably is a sort of synthesis of various characters of that kind in that world.
Is it my imagination? These people aren't really Bloomsbury, but they're kind of on the fringes of it. Is that about right?
I think that's right, yes. Bloomsbury sort of grew out of Cambridge in a way. Cecil, I suppose, is, you know, he knew Lytton Strachey and so forth. He's on the margins of that. And who knows, you know, if he hadn't been killed in the Great War, he might have had a more Bloomsbury existence thereafter. But I didn't really want to enter into the whole world and atmosphere of the Bloomsbury group itself. I wanted to create something of a sense in that 1920s world of the new candor about sex, and you know, Dudley referring to Cecil's bugger friends and so on. Which is, bugger was very much the kind of Bloomsbury word for homosexuality, and it had this sort of brisk, no-nonsense kind of quality to it. And I wanted Daphne, too, to find herself rather at sea in this world of ambiguous sexuality, which I think was so typical of the Bloomsbury group, you know, where people all the members of the religious group were, seemed to be having affairs with men and women sort of almost simultaneously. But I think there's something perhaps of that new moral atmosphere around the Bloomsbury group, but it's not a Bloomsbury novel.
I got the feeling that Daphne herself is aware and yet at the same time not aware of all this. She seems aware of Revel. She seems aware of Cecil. I don't know, maybe she's hiding it from herself, and if so, then you've done an interesting job of creating someone who lies to themselves.
Yes, I think, well, she's very young and innocent, 16-year-old girl in 1913, and has had no experience of men at all before, really. She's someone who lost her own father when she was very young, so I think I have the idea of her being repeatedly drawn to people who were going to disappear or let her down or who were not going to be able to satisfy her emotionally. She finds herself in the second part of the book married to a sort of mad brute, really. I think she finds in a sort of sexually ambiguous figure of Revel, who's clearly drawn to her as well, but probably in a much more light-hearted way. She sees him as a sort of rescuer from the trap of her marriage. But of course, one knows that people often escape from something bad into something not all that much better.
There's a remarkable passage. Daphne is an elderly woman, where she's thinking about the nature of memory, and she begins to wonder if all of her memories are not memories of the events, but memories of memories.
I think that's absolutely true, yes, and Daphne has the one scene in the later part of the book which is, sort of, again, from her point of view. She's had a day of being interviewed, and she's been sort of rattled. She lies awake at night sort of thinking about it. She's written a memoir herself, which is generally not been very well received and is thought to have been full of fabrications, which she more or less admits. When I think of what I can remember, you know, I think it's very hard to remember exactly more than a few words that someone said to me last week, much less 40 years ago. If that kind of, not documentary memory, but just things held in people's heads, is a basis for memoir, autobiography, other kinds of biography and history, one cannot but think that it's, you know, extremely shaky and fallible. Daphne thinks, she's pretty sure that anything that was said in her memoir, anything she had someone say, was something they probably had said within 5 or at the most 10 years of when she had them say it, but she can't really remember.
Unless somebody is sitting down and taking notes and working off notes, on some level, it pretty much means that all memoir and most biography is by necessity fiction.
Well, I think there's a very strong fictional element in any recreation of the past, and it might be more likely to be accurate if someone had kept a detailed diary at the time, for instance. But then, you know, writing a diary is an act of selection, interpretation. I mean, there's something inherently slightly fictional about it. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I think it's very shaky ground.
It's just as shaky ground to go back, say, you know, 50 years from now and read The Stranger's Child and decide that elements there are autobiographical to Alan Hollinghurst, where they may or may not be.
I'm not going to worry about that too much.
Well, Alan Hollinghurst, the chapel tomb, is there a real chapel tomb of any poet, modern poet, like the one of Cecil Valence in The Stranger's Child?
Not that I'm aware of, no, but I have seen tombs of that kind in the chapels of large country houses and so forth. There was one in a house in Worcestershire in the west of England that I saw years ago, which made quite an impression on me, a sort of white alabaster sort of reclining figure, obviously referring to the figures on the tombs of medieval knights and crusaders and so forth. That very sort of chivalric myth which people tried to cling to about the First World War, even though the war itself was so brutally different from that.
Did you always know, before writing the final section, exactly what Paul's book would comprise of?
Yes, well, we don't know exactly, but yes, I wanted him to embrace any rumour that was sort of passed under his nose and presented as fact, yes.
Alan Hollinghurst, why did you say in an interview that you think that your novel, The Spell, is probably your favorite book?
I think it's partly because it's the one which was least appreciated by other people, so I have there's an element of defiance in my fondness for it. It's in a way quite a simple book, but I don't know, I think it is a happier book than my other ones, and it was deliberately written in a sort of a lighter vein and a brighter key. and it was a book in which I emerged from the more claustrophobic world of two first-person novels, you know, and I felt the freedom of moving around from character to character. It's so hard to judge one's own book. I'm not sure if I think it's my best book, but I retain a fondness for the kind of atmosphere of it.
Going from Line of Beauty, which is another first-person book, into this and switching around must have been the same kind of feel.
Yes, I mean, the Line of Beauty is told in the third person, but it's all seen from the point of view of one character. So that does enable the author both to go into the inner world of the protagonist, but also to see him and other people from the outside. It seems to be the sort of ideal way in which I think I always want to write in future. But yes, it was quite liberate. I mean, I found it a tremendously exacting task to write a sort of 500-page novel with a large cast of characters seen all from the point of view of one person. So that there was a happy sense of freedom in moving around from one character to another.
It's funny that I remember Line of Beauty as being first person rather than third person, close POV. We see things through his eyes, and as a narrator, again, much like Daphne, he hides things from himself that he should see. So there's a connection there.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are ways, of course, famous ways one can do that in a first-person book, and you know, the dread thing of the unreliable narrator and so on. This isn't quite that, but I think it's easier perhaps to ironize the character's ignorance and self-deception if you're writing in the third person.
Alan Hollinghurst, did you do any work with Andrew Davies in the script of Line of Beauty?
Work would be a strong term. I mean, I was shown, I think, two successive drafts of the scripts for each of the three episodes, and I made some comments on them, which were generally listened to. I didn't have any power of veto or anything. Andrew said to me, frankly, at the beginning that he preferred his authors dead. he's adapting Jane Austen or Dickens or whatever. But also, there was undoubtedly some usefulness in being able to just email me and ask me something, you know, what a character might have done. And so. But I wouldn't really say that I had any significant input into it. It was important to me to hand it over to somebody else to do a quite different thing with it.
Well, what did you think of the final product?
I was quite pleased by it in general, I think. There were things, if I had had more say, I might have done differently. Things I had done differently in the first place. I think there were some wonderful performances in it. And young Dan Stevens, who played Nick, I think he's such a intelligent and subtle actor. I think he really sort of carried the thing in his first screen role. It was very nice. I thought that all the young people in the film were the age of the characters in the book, and most of them were doing their first film job, and so it had a sort of freshness about it in that way. The good thing about a TV miniseries is the amount of airtime that you get. The perhaps slightly less good thing is that the budget is much smaller than it would be for a cinema movie, and so it's a little bit sort of more modest in some of its effects than I would have liked.
Essentially, the book on the screen with changes is a far cry from what usually happens when you're moving from book to screen. So I was perfectly delighted with it, and I didn't mind whatever changes there were. But as an author, of course, you know, I'm sure that there were moments when you cringed.
You know, again, it's an earlier version of this question we were talking about in The Stranger's Child, of the things which I deliberately didn't describe in the book, but for the TV viewer have to be sort of brought out and explained. Things which happen in the gaps between the sections of the Line of Beauty. So Andrew Davies is extremely skilled at seeing what has to be done, and I didn't mind that.
In the Esquire interview, you said that it took you 8 different times to write the 1967 section. Is that correct?
I found starting the whole book very, very difficult, and I had to keep on rewriting it before I found I was coming in, you know, from the right angle at the right speed and at the right tone. Normally, the first page of a novel that I write with immense hesitation remains the first page, but in this case, I found it much more difficult. But I think the 1967 section was written fairly straightforwardly. Perhaps the very first page, again, the hesitation was duly prolonged.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview that Daphne, you thought, would take a bigger role than she did. Was there any character who kind of jumped out and took center stage in a way that you didn't expect?
No, I don't think so. I've never really quite believed in that thing that some writers say, you know, that the character just sort of ran away with me, and I go, I remain firmly in charge, thanks very much.
Well, also, the book is very, very planned out, and if you're going to constantly have to think back to the earlier sequences and you know the direction you're going in, then this book would be very charted out. You couldn't start at the beginning without knowing where you were going.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it would have been very, very worrying indeed.
Alan Hollinghurst, your first book was Swimming Pool Library. What kind of reception did you expect? I mean, it was a gay novel. There were a few gay novels at the time, but it hit the world by storm.
I didn't know what to expect. I loved writing it, and I sort of felt that I was doing something which hadn't really quite been done before within the confines of literary fiction, bringing together sort of quite complicated social historical things and a very frank account of gay sex life and so forth. But by the same token, I could see that this was something that might not go down well, and people were very cautious about the book before it came out. It was impossible to sell the paperback rights before it was published in hardback. My publisher in England said that they didn't think they could sell it in paperback, which was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because it then went on to be a big bestseller, and translation rights were sold all over the world. And I then sold the paperback rights for a hugely bigger sum. I think the publishers themselves probably were taken by surprise, the success of the book.
Has there ever been any talk about a film or miniseries?
Yes, there has. I've sold options on it a number of times. And in the early 90s, the BBC commissioned a very good British playwright called Kevin Elliott to do a three-part adaptation of it, which they sat on for ages but never made.
And Line of Beauty, if, I don't know, maybe Folding Star did as well, but certainly Line of Beauty took you out of any genre, if gay novel is a genre. But I guess from your perspective, you were never really in a genre as a writer anyway.
I didn't think of myself as such. You know, inevitably, I was sort of, my books appeared in the gay sections in bookshops when gay sections of bookshops still existed. But I was always anxious that they should also be in the main fiction section. From the start, I knew that there was something called gay fiction, which was written usually by gay writers for a gay readership, probably published by a gay press. And I knew I wanted to do something a bit more ambitious than that. I felt that there was a repeated desire to sort of put me back in my category, as it were, and it emerged, you know, after the Line of Beauty won the Booker Prize. There was a gay novel, wins Booker, but you know, which is not something that I want to deny, but it never seemed to me the whole point of what I was doing.
Do you think the Booker Prize gave you a certain freedom in terms of writing a book like Stranger's Child, where you didn't have to think about gay sex scenes?
Well, possibly, yeah. Yes, I did. I think I found it a very encouraging thing to happen. And I thought, well, this is the time, you know, when I've got a captive audience who will be waiting for my new book more keenly than they have for anything else, and I can do whatever I like.
Well, it struck me at my end that rather than even thinking about Line of Beauty as a gay novel, it was almost the archetypal novel of Thatcherite England. I mean, so it became, in essence, not a gay novel, but a political novel.
Yes, I think that's right. If I'd written, for instance, about the AIDS crisis sort of 10 years earlier, I think, you know, I would have been writing a different kind of book. I didn't do that, and I wrote about it in this larger context of a portrait of the 80s, in which it was already a sort of known historical fact. I'm pleased you say that. Yeah, I thought of it as something in which the gay element would be very strong, and as always act as a form of criticism, as it were, of the society of which it's a strand. You know, it's a dissident position, if you like, and it's one for which one looks at the big straight world with a particularly critical eye.
As you've said, writing about gay life in 2011 is very different from writing about it 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or more. You know, as you say, the genre has kind of vanished. But what I've noticed, which has nothing to do with gay life, is there seems to be, maybe it's just what I'm reading, more of an interest in World War I than we've seen in a long time. Not just in your work, but in other things as well. And I'm wondering about that. It seems that World War I changed society, turned it modern. And yet at the same time, of course, much like Iraq or Vietnam, it was utterly unnecessary.
That's right, yes. I think, I mean, it's something which is in a way is charted in this book, the emergence of interest in the war. You know, there's the thing in the years after the war, people saying, you know, everybody's sick of the war, which I think they were, but at the same time, you know, they couldn't get away from it or stop thinking about it because it had altered and damaged their lives so deeply. Then I think at the time when I was a schoolboy in the later 60s was a time when the war poets and war literature sort of came very much into the school syllabus and so on, and I think it's still the case in Britain, you know, that school children all learn about Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon in particular, and you know, I learnt poems by Wilfred Owen by heart when I was a schoolboy, and a sense of the centrality of the Great War in modern memory, to take the title of that book by Paul Fussell, which was, I think, such a revelation to me in sort of writing about the Great War and modern memory. Here was a war of a completely new kind, which the literary apparatus that people approached it with was completely inadequate to describe. You know, I think Rupert Brooke, for instance, is a poet who really only produces the old-fashioned kind of rhetoric about the war. The great thing about Owen is that he sort of found a new way of telling it like it actually was.
Well, when you consider the number of people who came back damaged, I mean, that was something that no one had ever seen before. I mean, thousands of people just in the mud, you know, being destroyed by mustard gas. I mean, that's primitive and yet unbelievably vicious at the same time.
I think that's absolutely right. It was beyond anything that anybody had ever conceived before, the scale of it, the intensity of suffering and new forms of suffering. Yes. And the way it went on and on and on, the pouring of hundreds of thousands of lives into this great sort of these vast military efforts which gained nothing at all.
And then came World War II, and suddenly it was almost as if it had been wiped off the historical map. And now it's making a comeback. I'm not sure.
I wanted in the book to create a sense of that sort of cyclical thing of the war. You know, the wars, a war is always going on, and it's something one's so conscious of now. We're seeing on the television, you know, the coffins coming back from Afghanistan every week. And I'd originally thought of making the final section of the book sort of to bring out the element of the war and have someone who'd been a soldier in the Gulf War in it, and then I thought this was actually getting too thematically heavy-handed. But of course, the Second War also makes its, again, happens in a kind of interval between the episodes of the novel, but it also makes its mark on, you know, it kills one of the major characters, and it's a character we only meet in the 1967 section is sort of very mentally affected by his experience of the war.
And the final section involves a book dealer. And I guess he's just a viewer. Or in your own mind, how fully formed was that particular character?
He's not a very fully formed character, yes, but he's someone who's sort of trading in whatever may be left of the period of which we entered the novel. He has a little specialised line in sort of gay lives and so on, finding out of the way things for customers. He's an online bookseller, so the whole world of sort of total information in which he inhabits, I hope to ironize that slightly against the reader's sense of all the things which actually, you know, still cannot know.
And of course, his view of Paul suddenly gives us a completely different view of Paul, because we've only seen things from Paul's perspective and a little bit Peter's. They see themselves as young people, and then they're old, and we're looking at Paul, and we're seeing someone entirely different, which must have been fun for you to write.
Well, it was another of those little shocks in the book, yes, which I did enjoy, the sort of seeing someone that we'd been rather inward with suddenly from outside, from a quite different perspective, and after a large gap of years. The fourth section of the book, where Paul is researching his biography, it's almost entirely seen from his point of view, but I think the reader will pick up on the thing that he's not a very welcome figure to a lot of the people that he's talking to. it's not quite clear how much he registers his own unpopularity with them.
How does writing a book like this change you? Does it change you?
It seems to me to be a book which was very much integrated into my own sense of life at the moment, moving through my mid-50s, more and more assailed by these questions of memory, the fallibility of my own memory, people dying, and so forth. So it felt perhaps more than what I'd written before, a sort of exploration of my own state of mind. It is a book very much about the passing of time and what sense we make of the time that has passed. So perhaps it surprised me by being a very personal experience.
Alan Hollinghurst, had you started working on another book, or are you planning to wait another several years?
I do hope not to wait quite so long. I've got some early inklings of another book, but I'm not nearly ready to start writing it yet. I'm quite enjoying not writing a book at the moment.
How about short stories?
I wrote one short story after The Line of Beauty came out. Thought I was going to write a lot more, but things that I thought at one point might be short stories sort of started showing an affinity with each other and joined up and became a novel. I think I'm not by temperament a short story writer. I like the long stretch and the discovering of interconnectedness over a very wide canvas. I mean, I've written two short stories in my life. I wrote one in my 20s and one in my 50s. I suppose I might, if I'm lucky, have one more in me, but I'm not expecting it.
And you're currently translating Racine?
I've just done a translation of Racine's Berenice, yeah. Which was a lovely task to have to do after finishing a novel, when one can feel a bit adrift. So it's very nice to have something like that to do.
You've been listening to an interview with Alan Hollinghurst, whose latest book is The Stranger's Child. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.